Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 70, Tarot as Psychological Tool, January 9th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Part of my so-called mission with the tarot is to, what I call, remove the misappropriated gypsy garb from the tarot, which has done a great disservice. Of course, the New Age and tarot culture today kind of feeds that and shoots itself in the foot. But it's simply not accurate. The gypsies apparently didn't start actually using tarot cards to the 20th century.
That was the voice of Dr. Art Rosengarten, who is a Jungian-based licensed psychologist and widely recognized expert on the psychological use of tarot cards. He's author of the book Tarot and Psychology, Spectrums of Possibility, which was put out by Paragon in 2000, and he wrote the first accredited dissertation on tarot divination in 1985. He is both diplomate of the American Psychotherapy Association and serves on the advisory board of the American Tarot Association. He is also director of Intuition Mind Seminars, a continuing education program for therapists throughout California. He was a featured speaker at the World Tarot Congress in Chicago and has appeared twice on radio on the Art Bell Show, Coast to Coast. He practices in San Diego's North County and teaches the Tarot Circle, now in its 13th year. Here's the interview. Dr. Art Rosengarten, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Nice to be here. How are you, David?
I'm great, and it's good to have the opportunity to speak to you again. I should let our listeners know that you and I have met on a couple of occasions when I was attending workshops or lectures that you were giving. And I think it may come as something of a surprise to some, if not many of my listeners, that a couple of psychologists such as you and I would actually take the tarot seriously. So I'd like the main thrust of this interview to focus on how the tarot can be seen as a psychological tool, both for self-exploration and in the arsenal of the counselor and psychotherapist. So let's start off with, how did you first come to be involved with the tarot?
Well, I grew up in the 60s, and when I was 14, I was very interested in parapsychology and the work of Dr. Rhine down at Duke University.
Sure.
My first look at the mind, in alternative ways of viewing the mind. And then, when I got to graduate school, I was very interested in East-West psychology and Buddhism and Jungian psychology on the Western side of things. And I actually, in graduate school, I took a weekend seminar on the tarot given by a professor of mine in San Francisco at the Institute of Asian Studies. I was working on a master's at the time in East-West psychology. And when I saw these tarot cards, I was just amazed at their potential. They were magnificently rich images that could be used psychologically because of the obvious multi-level symbol content.
Yeah.
You get a tarot card, and you say, that can go anyway. I mean, that's just a really interesting thing for a therapist who is interested in the unconscious and things like that.
Okay. Okay, and the I'm blocking on her name. The person who taught that course is rather well known in the world of workshops and tarot and psychology. What's her name? Do you recall?
Oh, that You're talking about Angeles Arian?
Yeah, yeah. I was blocking on her name.
Okay, Angie Arian.
Right.
Actually, she was one of my teachers. She is a terrific teacher. She was coming out of really a Joseph Campbell sort of interest in archetypal mythology and the power of psychological symbols, these kind of post-Jungian thinkers. And the thing about the tarot is you've got now a whole symbol system that was really developed in the Renaissance, most likely, though we don't know. And it, you know, pictures and images are very rich psychological pieces of information that can be worked with, however, you know, a therapist might want to work with pictures, like dreams.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned the Renaissance. So, you know, there's so many different ideas out there about what the tarot is and where it comes from and how it's got its name and so on. And I know you've been something of a tarot scholar. So briefly take us through the history, if you will.
Well, the bottom line is no one knows who the first designer of the tarot was. It remains a mystery, and there are many theorists and historians today that are researching tarot origins. It's kind of an interesting topic. But the first known decks, I believe, emerged in the very early Renaissance in Europe, mostly in Italy and various other places in Europe. And I think our earliest decks are dated about 1420 or so. It's speculated that the real origins of the tarot come from the ancient world, in terms of the ancient mystery schools and the Neoplatonists and Pythagorean thinkers. Some have other ideas about the origins of tarot. They could have come from the East, from China or India, even, and typically, most scholars today credit the Italian Renaissance as really the birthplace of what we call the tarot.
Okay. And I know there's some theorization about its name and, you know, what those letters of T-A-R-O-T stand for.
Right. Well, there was a 20th century tarotist named Paul Foster Case, who came up with this interesting palindrome about the origins of tarot that went, I think, rota, tarot, orat, the wheel of tarot teaches the law, Torah, ator. So it's different variations of the letters in the word tarot.
Yeah, if you put the letters in a wheel going around a circle left to right, T-A-R-O-T, and then you start at different places, you get those different words that you just used.
Right. So what it translates as, the wheel of tarot teaches the law of Ator. Now, who is Ator? Well, Ator is Hathor, the Egyptian goddess of all the gods, the great feminine principle, the cow goddess of ancient Egypt. So there's been a lot of speculation that the tarot ultimately derives from ancient Egypt. And in that sense, the tarot would be a tool of the great goddess religions, mm-hmm. the great deep feminine. It's, mm-hmm. But in fact, if you look at the construction of the tarot deck, the standard tarot deck, you'll see that, you know, it's very rich in both masculine and feminine gods and goddesses, which in modern psychological language we would call archetypes.
Right.
And so there's great image. It's actually a very modern piece of work in that it's very universalist. It's very in touch with both feminine images and masculine images, and in that way, it kind of breaks out of any single belief system psychological or theological or philosophical. It can be used. It's very eclectic. Mm-hmm. It can be used in many, many different ways. And part of my work is just teaching how versatile this system of symbols really is. It can be used across the board in various contexts.
Right. So before you go into any of that, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the deck. Maybe you can describe the structure of the deck a bit in terms of the suits and the lower and higher arcana and the relationship to our regular playing cards.
Right. You could say that our regular playing cards, deck of 52 playing cards, are the lower deck of the tarot, the minor arcana. Though in tarot, instead of 52 cards, the suit cards, there's 56, owing to an extra court card where we have in playing cards, we have the jack, queen, king. In the tarot, they have a jack, knight, queen, king. So there's four knights in addition to the standard playing cards. Now, each of these cards are symbols as opposed to playing cards, which are all about signs. They don't have meaning at all. They are what they appear to be, so that a queen of spades is simply a queen of spades. It has a numeric value, whereas the queen of wands in the tarot, say, that can mean many, many things.
Yeah, and the pictorially, it's a much richer image with lots of symbols embedded in it and so on.
Truly. Now, you could, if you really want to understand the structure of tarot, you could think of the whole deck of tarot as a deck of five cards only. There's the five cards would be the four aces, the ace of pentacles, which is the ace of earth, the element earth, the ace of air or swords, the ace of cups or water, and the ace of wands or fire. Those are the four classic elements that really throughout history have been used as kind of the primary qualities that describe all things that human beings experience in the their most basic level, and not literally but symbolically. And then there's the fifth element, and that would be spirit. So, and that is what the second deck, or the major arcana, is really about. It's the deck of the of spirit. And the card, the fifth card that really subsumes all of the spirit cards, is the Fool. So mm-hmm. within the Fool card, which has the numeric value of zero, all of the 22 major arcana, or the trump cards, these are really the archetypes of transformation that Jung wrote about, are all included inside, really, the Fool card. If you could look with a metaphysical microscope into the Fool card, you'd see all of the trump cards in that one card.
I've never heard that put forth before. That's an interesting idea. So there are 56 cards, which are the lower arcana. Then there are another 22, is that right? Which are the
correct
higher arcana, for a total of 78?
Eight, correct.
And did our regular playing card deck, is that a descendant of the tarot? Or is it the other way around?
It's a chicken or egg thing. I think that, on a deeper level, that these things are somewhat independent of one another, but they emerged in history more or less, showing up in different places in the world roughly at the same time, in the Middle Ages and during the Renaissance. But given the fact that we really don't know the ancient history of cards that well, it's very speculative. But I think that both playing cards and gaming, and the whole archetype of gaming and gambling, and so-called divination and fortune-telling, word that I really don't like, but we could call it that, these ultimately are timeless and universal activities that human culture has created in many different guises and many different times. And so it's not correct to look so empirically at dates and when. Ultimately, these are expressions of imagination and the deep unconscious in the human psyche.
Okay.
Both ways.
Okay. Now, you mentioned fortune telling, and many people are turned off to the tarot, either because they were told at some point by some religious authority that the cards are the tool of the devil, or because they associate it with shady fortune tellers. So how do you deal with these sorts of concerns?
Well, I teach mostly licensed therapists, and actually many of my clients that I work with the tarot are therapists. And what part of my so-called mission with the tarot is to what I call remove the misappropriated gypsy garb from the tarot, which has done a great disservice. Of course, the New Age and tarot culture today kind of feeds that and shoots itself in the foot. But it's simply not accurate. The gypsies apparently didn't start actually using tarot cards to the 20th century. They're more associated with playing cards. And the tarot, the earliest decks of tarot that we have in existence today, they have been dated to a time in Europe that preceded the arrival of the first gypsies by, I think, some 20 to 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's really not about the gypsies, though it's obvious. It carries that mythology that would lend itself to our view of gypsies and perhaps to the gypsies' view of themselves. But ultimately, it's a map of consciousness, and it really assembles in a very embedded, compact way, I believe, a whole compendium of ancient knowledge, Gnosticism and Hermeticism, pertaining to the deep spiritual initiation and awareness.
Okay.
So that's what it's really about.
Yeah, and so now you're trending towards my next question, which is, what is the intersection of tarot with psychology?
Well, it's, you know, my book, Tarot and Psychology, Spectrums of Possibility, certainly was completely about that question, but I can answer it, you know, the shortcut way
okay.
or a full way, because that is a great discussion, I feel. Certainly, if you want to look at the 20th century psychology, we can look at the year 1900 when Freud published Interpretation of Dreams as one of those landmark years that gave birth to modern psychology, I think.
Yes.
But what we should know is that in the decade before, Freud himself, according to some texts, was experimenting with Jewish mysticism and used to play with tarot cards or tarocchi. Not that he was using them the way we think of now, but a card game that is really a German card game that's based on tarot. It's a kind of a relative of tarot. And it's speculated he used to play with it in his B'nai B'rith men's club meetings weekly after kind of shooting the bull about mystical, metaphysical topics that were part of the discussion of Kabbalah and the Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that time, there were a lot of theories out in terms of the magical tarot theorists of the 19th century that the tarot was a direct descendant of the Kabbalah, owing to the 22 trump cards that we mentioned correlating with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet and esoteric Kabbalah is really sees that words and letters are symbols for deeper spiritual experience. And it's like a code. So it's speculated that Freud himself was playing around or open to kind of the world of the unconscious and symbols that one might find in psychological tarot.
Yeah, and then along comes Jung, and certainly Jung's ideas.
More obvious person that in the 20th century, Jung's impact on the tarot has been immense because he's given us a whole coherent language and system to talk about the non-rational, in terms of intuition, four functions of the personality, the deep unconscious, the collective unconscious, the archetypes. And Jung also coined the word synchronicity, which really, I believe, is the mechanism by which divination or random selection of symbols works. So Jung obviously has a tremendous contribution in the 20th century of opening up this Renaissance symbol system into a tool of transformation and symbolism and consciousness.
Yes. Maybe you can say a little bit more about synchronicity and this term that you use, divination, because I think you use divination in a way that you differentiate a little bit from fortune telling, and yet they seem to kind of shade into each other that I'm not sure everybody would grasp that distinction very well.
Well, if you know, psychologists, just as psychologists know that psychotherapy is really not about fixing the personality, but it's more about exploring a person's subjective life, perhaps, and looking at possibilities and looking at issues and problems and trying to get more awareness and focus on certain areas of life. That's what working with tarot cards, selecting a group of symbols in a spontaneous way, and then not so much telling fortunes or telling futures. That's just a phrase, just like we don't fix personalities as therapists. But really, we engage in the same kind of exploratory discovery process when we have maybe a group of, say, 5 to 10 of these spontaneously picked symbols that are like archetypes. They're very rich. They have many, many levels of meaning. And it becomes speculative. And this is what divination is. It's an archaic term. I call it more modern way. It's empowered random selection of symbols, and it works on a principle that used to be called an oracle. It's not fortune telling, but it's an oracular technique. And what an oracle really does, if we want to talk about it in contemporary language, is an oracle translates a problem, an identified issue that we may come to the process with, and he translates a problem into an image language like that of dreams. It deconstructs a problem through images, and then it allows us access into the nature of the problem by amplifying these symbols or these images, so that we don't reduce problems down to cause and effect or some kind of expedient, narrow answer, but we open up problems. And what happens with the tarot is as we translate it with symbols, problems all of a sudden expand our level of understanding, our perception and our perspective into usually spiritual areas or transpersonal areas of possibility. Now, so problems and questions get much larger. This is what I mean by divination.
And okay.
So it's you know, it's almost the opposite of the the popular projection and spin, the popular perception of what fortune telling and what people do with cards. It doesn't predict what is going to happen at all. I, for one, don't really even believe in the future. I don't really put much stock in making predictions about what will be, because I believe everything occurs in the now, mm-hmm. in the dynamic present moment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there may be other types of users of the tarot that are very comfortable with a nice linear view of how life unfolds and how people come to their issues, etc. And they can use the tarot cards just as well to support their own way of thinking and their own way of looking, because these cards themselves are foundationless. They can be used to amplify or discuss or explore really almost any point of view.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they're extremely versatile, if anything.
Yes.
They're greatly versatile.
Right. You know, with a synchronicity, I guess the way that I look at it, you know, when we draw cards, well, synchronicity is kind of a coincidence that feels too coincidental to be coincidental. That's how I think of it. Jung talks about it as meaningful coincidentals, things that happen that in some kind of, I'm losing my words here, in some kind of proximity so that we experience them as being related. And so, you know, I approach the tarot in terms of, say, drawing cards with kind of an open-minded hypothesis that maybe there's going to be some very strong, meaningful coincidence. Maybe these cards that I draw are not accidental. And and sometimes they feel accidental, but many times, and I'd say more than one would expect on average, they seem to be quite meaningful and not at all accidental.
Well, yes. My experience, however, is more than that. My experience is they're always, and I hate to be absolutist,
okay,
but they are always accurate. However, accurate is not accurate. Accurate is the wrong word to be using in this. Accurate means is completely inappropriate way of describing it, because compared to what? Accurate compared to our kind of normative understanding or consensual understanding of what is supposed to be happening. That's not so important to me to determine is it, quote, accurate or not. The better word in my experience is relevant. Mm-hmm. Is a reading, if we kind of pull these cards rather blindly and spontaneously in the present moment and opened ourselves to looking at these patterns that are here and maybe free associating and allowing the cards to kind of take us to this place that they where they are, what they're representing, many places that they're representing, will that be relevant to our lives and who we are and our thought process and the problem we may start off with? And I say, yes, it will. All the time, mm-hmm. it will be relevant, barring one condition. And that one condition is sincerity, actually. If a person is sincere and open to the experiment, and I think of a tarot reading really as an experiment,
mm-hmm.
And if a person is open to really being truthful to the moment and what's going on and looking without and puts their defenses down and kind of is willing to explore, it can't help but be relevant in the moment. It's the nature of it to be relevant in the moment. That's what tarot is, because it's a compendium of psychological DNA.
Yeah,
we are tarot decks. I have a little paper I wrote called We are walking tarot decks. The tarot cards are symbolically carrying the very makeup and stuff of the human mind, of the human experience. So when we open up to a small set in that moment and are forced to go down that avenue of discovery, it can't really, if we're open and sincere, it can't help but be relevant, because we're just looking at another part of ourselves. It just works that way.
I agree with you about it working every time. If it's an interactive process, that is, if the person who's receiving the reading is maybe interacting with the person who's giving the reading, and there's mutual exploration going on, or there's at least inner exploration going on, and maybe some feedback from the person who's receiving the reading, rather than somebody who just goes, it's like get the silver bullet. Okay, you tell me the answers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree with you. It's a synthetic process, you know. But David, isn't it the same as in psychotherapy? Isn't really the mark of an effective treatment? One where, you know, your basic Rogerian humanistic client-centered principles are on some level in effect, where it's a shared process and it's a discovery process.
Definitely.
And it's really not a kind of dictatorial authority prescribing some remedy to, you know, a passive patient. That does not work in the field of psychotherapy, I don't believe. And it's the same thing with the tarot. It's a shared discovery process.
Yeah, a shared and the fact that it's so symbolic and so open, it really invites spaciousness and exploration.
Absolutely.
Rather than narrowing things down to a definite answers. Now, speaking of psychotherapy.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you actually did. That's the problem with doing things where we can't see each other. So it's always hard to sort of exchange those little signals that say, okay, now I want to say something.
Yes.
Speaking of psychotherapy, you actually did your doctoral dissertation on the use of tarot in therapy. So kind of briefly, what did you do and how did it turn out? And what did you learn from that?
Well, it was called Accessing the Unconscious, Comparative Study of Dreams, TAT, and Tarot.
And now we should tell people that TAT,
Thematic Apperception Test, which is next to the Rorschach, is the second largest or most widely used projective test. So all three of these were image tools. The Tarot was most controversial in that it was based on random blind selection. Essentially, it was an elaborate and really a great piece of work, I think, when I was in school in San Francisco, where I ran dream groups and had people submitting their 12-week dream journal, which I then sent out to professional dream analysts. And during that time, I also had hired a psychologist to administer a TAT protocol to the same group of same subjects, mm-hmm. and then I sent that out to that protocol to three assessment psychologists to interpret what they saw with the same population. And then finally, I hired a professional tarot reader, and then with the tarot readings of each of these people, I sent those transcripts out to three more professional tarot interpreters, and I had them all fill out a questionnaire that I had designed on each person. So I had a tremendous amount of data on these people, and then I basically correlated these different treatment groups and compared them both with themselves and between groups. You know, I've compared all the tarot experts with each other to see if they were seeing the same thing as I did the dream and TAT people.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, myself and my co-therapists in the dream groups, we ourselves filled out the same questionnaire that all these people were filling out. From our own direct experience of each of these subjects, we independently filled out our own questionnaire impressions of who these people were on the same 10-question questionnaire. And then all this data was correlated. And it's rather complex. I don't need to go into all of that. But what I found at the end of the day, and then we did a, you know, a correlation study. What we found at the end of the day was the tarot readers were about as reliable and valid in what they did as the TAT assessment psychologists. And the dream analysts were the best of the bunch in terms of the data they had. But in particular areas, you know, the tarot people were at least as reliable. Now, these are soft methods, you have to understand. We're talking about measuring the unconscious, which is fraught with its own implicit problematics. That's why there's not a lot of studies, empirical studies of, you know, the unconscious, because it's such a random, seemingly random and invisible realm.
Yes.
However, what became real clear to me at the conclusion was, I got, at least in a pilot study, something phenomenal that I showed reliability with this tarot method. And this was a method that was based on random chance. You know, it was based on, as opposed to the other methods, which had a causation that you could account for. This was magical, and it was reliable in under quantitative analysis. That was extremely interesting.
Yes. Well, I will refer people to your book because you describe it in detail, and you give examples of the kinds of materials that people presented in the book. And that's Tarot and Psychology.
Actually, to clarify that, no, that was a different study.
Oh, really?
That was my study on perpetrators and victims of domestic violence and tarot card readings. That was my second study, which is in that book.
Oh, okay.
I've done two empirical studies of with the tarot. My second study was actually going into treatment centers of court-mandated perpetrators of domestic violence, getting volunteer group of men who came out of this program to participate in tarot readings. And then I did a complete quantitative analysis of the tarot cards that these men pulled to see if there were any patterns that would emerge from out of the population of perpetrators through the tarot, and if to kind of draw up a composite profile of the perpetrator of domestic violence. And that was an extremely interesting study. And I also did that with victims of domestic violence and went into women's shelters and did the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole nother study.
Okay. And you're using tarot in therapy that you do today, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
I do.
Give us a sense of how you would use it in therapy and if there's a case example that you could give.
Okay. Well, there's so many different ways that I use it in therapy. That I'm having a little problem here with turning something off. Excuse me.
Yeah, I can hear a little twiddle in the background.
I apologize for that. You see, I am a fairly conservative therapist, and I certainly would not introduce the tarot to someone. I'm an eclectic talk therapist, and while I use certain tools like sample therapy, dream analysis, meditation. These are adjunctive tools that, mm-hmm. like many therapists, from time to time, depending on the patient and the course of a treatment, may be brought into therapy.
Okay.
I would do that for one thing. I do sample therapy, and I've included in my collection of sample tarot cards. So I have tarot cards that get mixed into a sandbox, mm-hmm. with three-dimensional objects, and they're marvelous symbols.
Yes.
In group therapy, I've often used in terms of exercises, maybe to start a conversation on a particular topic. I may use, you know, I've developed hundreds, literally hundreds of exercises using the selection of one or a few tarot cards as springboards for various therapeutic interventions.
Mm-hmm.
I have often I get psychologists and therapists and counselors and professionals coming in for tarot readings because they are therapists themselves, know the limitations of psychotherapy, I hate to say it, but and also are looking for a more direct and more powerful method than simple talk therapy, because you know the talk therapy often goes as far as the talent and the development of the therapist permits, and the tarot does not. The tarot is much has a much larger knowledge base, if you will, than the most gifted therapist. And somehow when you bring do what I call a divination or an experiment with a client under the right, once in the right context, I wouldn't do that in the beginning of a treatment, but let's say I'm 4 months into a weekly therapeutic course and we've come to a plateau period. We've talked things out or we're looking for something deeper. I might suggest let's take out the tarot symbols. We can do a reading and talk about it, and let's see what that really mirrors in your process right now. Mm-hmm. And if the person's receptive, I've done this many, many times. It always opens up a transpersonal or a spiritually based backdrop. Mm-hmm. To the conversation. It always kind of allows a person to look at the deep growth issues that are latent in whatever the particular situational context we're talking about. Maybe there's a family issue that we're dealing with, or a drinking issue, or something like that. When you bring a tarot reading to a therapeutic process, that issue gets reframed on its spiritual, transpersonal level, typically. And because the cards are so rich in their symbolism, and they're not really talking about a religion so much as deep levels of healing, wholeness, the spiritual journey, that language. It just starts to emerge spontaneously, because that's the nature of these symbols.
Well, maybe we could do something with that right now. Maybe it would be fun for our listeners to hear you do a reading for me on what qualities I need to develop to maximize the success of Shrink Wrap Radio. What do you think?
This is possible.
Well, I have a Rider-Waite tarot deck here that I've already shuffled, just in case you were up for this, and I could draw one or more cards from it as you direct.
Well, let's do this, because the best way, and I do readings now over the phone, and I found that it works quite well, just as well as face-to-face. And but for radio audience or listening audience, a short and direct reading is probably the best, because it's easier to visualize. So I would say we should pick three cards. And the first card that I'm going to ask you to select spontaneously. Now, this deck has been shuffled.
Yes, it has.
Okay. You need to, with a deck of 78 cards, you need to shuffle at least 10 times to mathematically randomize or naturalize a deck of 78 cards. So assuming that they've been completely randomized, the first card that I want you to select will represent this, what's called a spread position. And the position says the way it appears to be in this conversation. So your question is how to
maximize the success of Shrink Wrap Radio.
Okay. So the first card will represent how that appears as you ask the question. So go ahead and select the card.
Okay. I've done that.
And tell me what you have.
Okay, I have the devil. And the devil is, just for our listeners out there in the Rider Waite, it shows this sort of beast-looking creature with bat wings and two horns, and he's holding a hand up as if saying stop, and he's got a male and female beneath him who are chained to a pillar that he's perched on.
Well, thank you, David, for helping me dispel all of the superstition and fear associated with the tower.
This is one of the cards that, if you've got a newbie, it scares the pants off them.
Right. Now, this is the first card that people, you know, who don't understand the tarot will say, oh, the devil. But now, in modern parlance, the devil is the shadow. Okay, mm-hmm. And every card in the tarot has a positive and a negative side. Only the devil tends to carry as much negativity as any card in the entire deck. You can see that there is a chain or a chain binding the two naked figures beneath that bestial figure, and that you could call that the symbolizing the chain of attachment and. It really is about the devil. The key words I use for the devil are attachment, delusion, addiction. There's and duality, and there's a sense of these. There's very much of a. In the question, the way it appears, how to improve shrink wrap, I guess is the simplest way of saying it. The devil appearing there is, I'm wondering if there is...
The way I phrased the question...
Charge to that.
Yeah, the way I phrased the question was, what qualities do I need to develop to maximize the success of shrink wrap radio?
Right. You know, because in the spread position is how it appears. It almost appears like this is a shadowy question to be asking for you. It almost it may appear. This is my association. Then I'll ask you as if you're looking for kind of. It's almost like a Faustian deal. You know, selling yourself out to the devil to improve your product here. It appears like, how can I use this, you know, this metaphysical tool to, make things, you know, to increase my gain or something like that. And that's because the first position of this three card reading is appearances. So I would say you come in with the question, with a somewhat of a, there's a suspect or almost shadowy dimension to your question itself is, how can I use this sacred technology for increase? Now, that's where I go. Not that I necessarily believe that, but that's where the reading begins. I don't know. What are your... what is your association to those two things together?
Well, one of the based on what you just said, one of the things that comes up is there's the whole question in podcasting generally, and in mine in particular, of financial gain. And originally, I did this just out of the love of it and wanting to share with people and as a hobby. But then, as I got into it, I found there were expenses, and so I've sought sponsors and tried to find a way to generate a little bit of money doing it. So that's one thing that comes up. The idea of being chained, too, somehow relates to, it's easy for me to slip into a feeling of real obligation, I got to get so many shows out. And, and it could easily, there's the danger that it would that it would grow stale and not be springing from the place of spontaneity and love, but rather from a kind of obligation. So those are a couple of thoughts that come up right away.
And that's the kind of territory that the first card is opening up. The other thing I would just ask you to look at too is attachment. Are you attached to result here? Are you attached to success with it? Is that perhaps could that in some way be in competition with your, say, your pure motive of providing a service to people?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. The whole issue of attachment is meaningful. I mean, we could explore that for quite a while.
Right. Okay, so that's the first card, and that's the way it appears. Now, the second card that I'm going to ask you to select is in the position of what's really going on.
Okay.
So the first was, that's the way it appears, but now we want to hear what's really going on with this question.
Okay, we're working without a net here, folks. I'm laying my soul on the line here.
Absolutely.
I have drawn the Eight of Pentacles, which for our listening audience, it depicts kind of a guy who I would consider maybe to be a craftsman, and he's got a hammer and chisel, and he's chiseling out the pattern of a five-pointed star. He's on his workbench, and there are seven other stars in the card that maybe he's produced, that one laying on the ground, and the others are kind of going up vertically up what looks like a tree.
That's correct. And the cobbler. And this is the workhorse. This is the apprentice who turns things out like hotcakes, who has tremendous, what you could call karma yoga or work energy, who is apprenticing under a master craftsman and is now given just opportunity to keep on producing as he hones in and perfects his craft. And it's a perfect card, I think. Of course, I would think that because I'm biased to think it that way, you might say. So we started off in, your question about how to, optimize.
Mm-hmm.
It appears like, am I being attached? Am I being petty or hung up? Or am I kind of dealing with power issues with that devil card? But no, that's not what's really going on. What's really going on in your question is this is part of the process. You are now engaged as an apprentice in the path of becoming a master broadcaster or a master of what it is that podcaster, what it is that you're doing, or educator, global educator, or whatever it is that are your highest aspirations here. And so what's really going on, and that's the name of this position, what's really going on, is this is just a part of the process. This is what happens when you're at this stage of productivity. Yeah, you have these questions. Yeah, you have these doubts, and sometimes you wonder, is the devil driving me? Mm-hmm. But no, this is a par for the course. This is being an apprentice right now. Your craft.
You know, I didn't mention it, but I could mention the fact that the first card, the devil card, was upside down. Now, okay. I know sometimes we make something of the fact that a card comes in upside down, and sometimes we choose to ignore it.
Well, I it's a big question in the tarot world. In my classes, I do teach people to read reversals, which gives a second set to the meaning, so we jump from 78 cards to 156. The devil, when it's in its reversed state, indicates the shadow side of a particular card, or that the person is struggling with that particular issue. That's what the reversal part means. The other side, way of working with reversals, is that it's the interior dimension of the devil. It's the it's like inner tennis. This is the inner devil when it's reversed that you can think of. Now, if you don't want to deal with reversals because they're more complex, you just basically have to have a more two-sided interpretation. So it's not absolutely necessary that we talk about the reversal.
Okay, well, we better keep moving here.
Yeah, right. Now, your third card.
Okay.
And the third card represents what needs to come out now. where you need to pay special attention now in this conversation in terms of your question.
And the card that I've drawn is the card known as the Hermit. And
yes.
the Hermit depicts this fellow in a sort of robe with a cowl, older fellow with a white beard. It looks like he's standing on a snow-capped peak, and he's looking down. He has a staff in his left hand, and he has a lit lantern in his right hand.
Correct. And the Hermit card, actually, in my own new deck and system about the tarot, where I'm expanding the tarot deck, the Hermit's the most important card in the tarot, in my opinion, because it is the number 9, and that's numerology. Number 9 is extremely meaningful, but I'm not going to go into that long discussion. But what I can say about the Hermit card is, really, the Hermit card is individuation or spiritual individuation. It's the path of finding your own way to your deepest reality. And that's what the meaning of the Hermit is. It's the Hermit seeks his own salvation with diligence. He does his own thing. The Hermit is not concerned about collective approval so much. He stands alone. He's following his own inner dictates. And so what needs to come out is, even with the questions and the tremendous process of work that you're doing, you need to ultimately view this as in the service of your own individuation, that you're now opening up territory that's uniquely yours, and you're bringing something into the world that you've created here, and keep on ultimately finding yourself as your own reference and guide.
Yes, that's how I'm seeing this. Is it kind of says to me that I really need to keep an inner focus and, you know, listen to sort of inner guidance as this
exactly
unfolds.
Right. Exactly right.
You know what? We have, I think we're at the end of our time here. And
okay.
This was fun. And I think I should point out that there are many different spreads that you could have done with me. This is just one approach out of, as you say, you've invented hundreds of different ways of laying these cards out for interpretive purposes. So you can find out a lot more about this. I'll put a link to Art's website in case you want to find out more about what he's up to. And Art, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I had a lot of fun, David. It was great.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation on Tarot with Dr. Art Rosengarten. About 6 years ago, I heard Art give a talk, and he said something that really grabbed my attention and that has stuck with me ever since. He said, working with Tarot is just like working with dreams, except a person doesn't always remember a dream, but you can always have the Tarot cards available. That really clicked for me because I had been teaching dream classes and doing dream work for quite a few years. And it's true that the people I want to work with don't always have a dream that they remember. Now, I've been using Tarot cards for quite a while before that. In fact, Art and I probably first took up Tarot at about the same time in our lives. But I never used it for readings, rather just as an archetypal stimulus source for teaching and for group work. Art's remarks stimulated me to do more reading on Tarot, and eventually to even put myself out as a Tarot reader in the European workshops I was doing with Ron Alexander. And when I say I was doing readings, I don't mean I was doing fortune-telling. Rather, I used the randomly drawn cards and spread as a way of engaging the person I was reading for in a mutual exploration of their question or issues. I had another insight in the course of my interview with my friend Dwight Webb on the Soul of Counseling. I realized that what I like about dream work and about Tarot is that these are tools that allow one to very quickly get down to a soulful level and to talk about and explore issues that have deep meaning for the person. And that, after all, is what drew me into the field of psychology in the first place.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
As always, I want to thank our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. As a matter of fact, if you go to podshow.com, you'll see that they are currently promoting us on their front page in the spirituality category. Check it out, podshow.com. And on our website, you'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain or web hosting needs. If you haven't done so yet, you can take our listener survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And there's a link on shrinkwrapradio.com. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise. It's been a while since I've talked about Frapper, so I want to welcome 6 new additions to our Frapper map. I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Rachel in Paris, Kirsten in Stockholm, Sweden, John in Storstrom, Denmark, Jude in Clayton, Maryland, Bert in Melbourne, Australia, and Brother Bernard in Broadheadsville, Pennsylvania. You can put yourself on our Frapper map. Just go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or there's a link on our website. This past weekend, I had the experience of introducing Scott D. Miller to an audience of about 200 therapists at an all-day workshop he was conducting in San Francisco. You'll recall that Scott was a guest here on Shrink Wrap Radio a few episodes back. And by the way, what a presenter he is in person. He could be a stand-up comedian. He was so entertaining. And I was very gratified when during the intermission, a therapist came up to me to say he had recently discovered Shrink Wrap Radio and had ordered Dwight Webb's book On the Soul of Counseling as a result. I was thrilled that in a random crowd of about 200 therapists, one was already a listener. I hope you'll help me make that a growing trend by promoting the show to folks you know who might be interested.
I'm Jack Ward from the Sonic Society podcast, and you're on the couch with Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, let's take a quick dip into the mailbag. I have to confess that I've been overwhelmed lately by a large marketing research project I've taken on, and it's really put me behind in terms of keeping up with my email. Plus, doing these longer interviews means I'm reading fewer emails on the air. But don't let that stop you from sending them, because I still thrive on them. First, I want to acknowledge a number of emails from Dennis in Las Vegas, if I recall correctly, who is a martial arts buff and who has been advising me about ways to strengthen my knees for my upcoming ski adventure. They're too long to read here, but Dennis, thanks for your support and the helpful links. I've interviewed a lot of therapists on this show, but we've not had an interview yet from the client side of things. Perhaps we will before too long. I did receive several emails from a 42-year-old listener, a woman, who has been up against it for some time. And because it's so personal, I'm leaving off her name and her state. In part, she writes, "Been in and out of therapy for almost 6 years and diagnosed with anything that ends in disorder. Started therapy at age 37 after separation and divorce. Atypical depression with psychotic features, PTSD, bipolar 2, borderline personality disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, dissociative disorder, attachment disorder, major depression, dysthymia, and a partridge in a pear tree," none of which is me. But I gather you've had all those diagnoses pinned on you, and that they weren't all that helpful. She goes on, "I am the most common sense person you'll meet, intelligent, spiritual, honest, stable, but with a brain that has thoughts moving as slow as a snail on tranquilizers. I can hold a thought longer than Bill Clinton argued what is means, and go to work, raise my kids, one of whom is autistic, and surf the internet way too much. Lifelong, from age of 3, history of physical/sexual/verbal abuse, and I'm just trying to heal mind/body from the depression I've had since age 13. Medications have not worked, lost count of how many have tried, maybe 18, currently down to trying MAOIs, and ready to give up medications. Therapy has been an awakening of my soul and emotions, and I can actually feel again instead of being numb and cold. It's been seeing the truth compared to my lies, and I feel I'm coming alive again emotionally and spiritually. But part of me is still cold, dead zombie. I remember one therapist saying I was a walking zombie, and he was pretty close to the truth, but ouch, thanks, Mr. Sensitive. I take care of myself physically and emotionally and do what the docs tell me to as far as I'm capable. But healing has hit a wall again, and there's part of me that is still locked away that no one has been able to help me unlock. It took me 3.5 years to trust my current therapist, but the only one I've been able to trust, and at times he doesn't know how to help me move forward, I think. But he's been the only one to help at all. He studied with Carl Rogers in California and is very intelligent and experienced. Would dress in a clown suit and dance if he thought it would help me. Was not able to talk without dissociative trance first year or so of therapy with him, but the therapist took it upon himself to educate himself after realizing the extent of my problem, and I can talk without dissociation for the past 2.5 years. I could put myself in a trance in 10 seconds. Who needs hypnosis? But now I'm able to talk without being tranced out. I am interested in MDMA therapy. MDA is a light hallucinogen, I believe, sometimes referred to as Atom, or what's the rave drug? I think it's a variant of ecstasy, maybe related. I'm interested in MDMA therapy as a key to break down resistance that continues to frustrate me regarding traumatic memories, etc. It feels like a white sheet / cement wall that comes over my mind at times, and my thoughts shut down, get confused, forget what I was talking about, etc. And now I just don't even go there in therapy, and my therapist doesn't challenge me as much because I think he gets frustrated too at times when I shut down / shut up. He doesn't show it, of course, but he's human after all. I'm unfortunately a master of resistant disaster, but still baby steppin'. Anyway, this is turning into a tome instead of an email. I love your program. Just found it through my stumble. Add on to my toolbar. Keep it up. Well, dear listener, thanks so much for sharing such a personal story. I'd love to have you on as a guest once you feel like you're pretty much on the other side of your troubles. You write very, very clearly and very evocatively. And it's clear that you are indeed very bright and sensitive, and you have lots of resources going for you. So I trust that you're going to be able to work your way through to the light. Yeah, and then when you're on the other side, maybe we can look back and see what was and what was not helpful. So next we hear from a student in Texas who writes, I'm a huge fan of your show, and I want to express my gratitude for it. Thank you. I appreciate you doing that. He says, I have a question for you. I will be attempting a university here in Texas, studying clinical psychology as an undergraduate. I more see myself as a research psychologist and a professor of psychology. So my question is, after receiving a PhD in clinical psychology, are those fields open to a person who studied in clinical psych? I'm more concerned with finishing my degree in counseling only to realize that I cannot become a teacher or a researcher with my degree. Any input is greatly appreciated. Edward in Texas. Well, Edward, there's some little background noises here that I think are coming through from my email. Edward, as I wrote to you, the important thing is to do lots of apprenticeships with researchers. Apprentice yourself to teachers who are involved in research all the way through your training, because that's what they look for in both to get into a PhD program, even in clinical psych, and particularly to get a job as a professor later. They're going to be very interested in your research career. You might even want to consider something other than clinical psych, some specialty that's more researchy, with the idea of doing a postdoc in clinical after you have your PhD. That can be another way to go. Of course, it involves more schooling, but generally a postdoc can be picked up in a year or two after you have the PhD. And I know some people who've done it that way. And then we have one more letter that I'll finish off with here. Dear Dr. Dave, I am enjoying your shows immensely. Thank you so much for your hard work and creativity in getting these podcasts together and utilizing this medium in such a useful way. I work as a graphic designer, but I'm a wannabe psychologist at heart and love your shows because they speak so directly to this part of me. I'm really glad to hear that. He says, I'm currently reading a book about the life of Dr. Timothy Leary called I Have Surrounded America by John Higgs. It's an excellent and engrossing read, and I highly recommend it. I would love to hear a discussion on your program about this controversial man and his life. Learn more about his theories and how he is regarded today from within the diverse community of psychological debate and criticism. Thanks again for your wonderful shows. Best wishes, Daryl, who writes from Cape Town, South Africa. Well, Daryl, as you might imagine, Timothy Leary's very controversial figure. He was when he was alive, and he still is when he's dead. And so the take that we would get on him would probably depend very much on who the guest was. If you've got a way of putting me in touch with this John Higgs, I'd certainly be interested in interviewing him. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. And alternatively, please leave voice messages on MyChingo. You'll find a link to that on the logo on our website. Just click on the MyChingo logo. And in the U.S., you can leave a voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. Thanks again to Gestalt therapist Dr. Dan Rosenblatt for the interview. Our next show will feature Dr. Darwin Church, who has co-authored a book all about healing with previous guest Dr. Norman Shealy. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.